This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden announced new steps to encourage COVID-19 vaccinations, including tax credit for employers who give workers paid time off to get their shot. More than half of American adults are now at least partially vaccinated, and the president is celebrating reaching his latest goal of 200 million shots administered in his first 100 days. Demand for shots is now a bigger issue than supply, as fewer people seek shots in several parts of the United States. Nearly half of the state of Iowa's counties are not accepting new doses because there's not enough demand. Florida's Palm Beach County will close mass vaccination clinics next month with thousands of available slots unfilled. And a clinic in the state of West Virginia is opening shots to out-of-state residents. An inspection by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration found problems at a factory manufacturing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The FDA found the factory in Baltimore, Maryland, was dirty, did not follow proper manufacturing procedures, and had poorly trained staff. The Food and Drug Administration released a statement in a 13-page report detailing the findings from its recent inspection of the now-idle Emergent Bioscience factory. Both Emergent and J&J say they are working to fix the problem as quickly as possible. That vaccine is on hold right now due to very rare blood clots. And more than 24 world leaders are set to speak Thursday on Earth Day at the virtual global summit on climate change organized by President Joe Biden. The global summit is part of Biden's effort to restore U.S. leadership after the dismissive attitude toward the issue by his predecessor. This is VOA News. Authorities in southwest Pakistan said Wednesday a powerful bomb ripped through the parking area of a five-star hotel, killing at least four people and wounding about a dozen others. The outlawed Pakistani Taliban militant group, through its social media outlets, claimed responsibility for the late-night suicide bombing at a hotel in Quetta, capital of the Balochistan province. In a prepared statement, the militants identified a meeting of local and Chinese foreign officials as the intended target. Pakistan's Interior Minister, Sheikh Rashid, said the bombing was a major security breach and a high-level investigation would be ordered to hold those responsible to account. The Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation into the police department in the Midwestern U.S. city of Minneapolis. Attorney General Merrick Garland's announcement Wednesday of the probe comes a day after a jury convicted former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the killing of George Floyd, triggering nationwide protests. The former white police officer was convicted on three counts in the murder of Floyd, a black man who died after being pinned in the street beneath Chauvin's knee for more than 9 minutes. In a statement, the Minneapolis police chief said he welcomes the investigation and that he and his department will cooperate fully. A search for an Indonesian submarine that went missing with 53 people on board continued Thursday after rescuers found an oil spill near where the vessel dived and as neighboring countries pledged to help. A Navy spokesman said the 44-year-old submarine was conducting a torpedo drill in waters north of the island of Bali on Wednesday, but failed to relay the results as expected. The Defense Ministry said two Navy vessels with sonar capability have been deployed to assist in the search. Australia, Singapore, and India have accepted Indonesia's call for help. Thousands of supporters of jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny gathered Wednesday in the center of Moscow, demanding his release and the access of doctors to examine his health. People were heard chanting freedom to Navalny and let doctors in, as numerous police asked them to disperse. Supporters of President Vladimir Putin's most prominent opponent fear he could soon die in prison where he is on a hunger strike. For more news, we invite you to join us at voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Some Chadians are feeling uneasy about the new Transitional Military Council.
I noticed that most of civil association and political parties and many of the population manifested their disapprobation concerning the council.
Kenya's High Court declares Chief Administrative Secretary positions unconstitutional. A Cameroonian startup creates a soil analysis kit for farming efficiency. Somalia braces for record displacement this year due to drought. And future jobs in Africa are in farming, but...
By 2040, about 1 in 4 people on Earth will be African. And so related to rural-urban divide, a lot of people wish for more farmers in their countries. When we asked them what they would recommend their kids to study, close to 5% only said farming or agriculture.
And the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights praises the guilty verdict of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There are reports that opposition political parties in Chad have urged Chadians not to obey what they are calling illegal and illegitimate decisions taken by the Transitional Military Council, including curfew and border closures. The council is led by General Mohamed Idriss Déby Itno, the 37-year-old son of the late President Idriss Déby. The opposition has also warned France not to interfere in Chadian internal affairs. Clement Abaifuta is the president of the Association of Victims of former Chadian President Issa Habré's crimes. He says many Chadians are disappointed by the formation of a military council because they had hoped for an all-inclusive transitional process.
About the council, many voices raised to protest and to contest, even the soldiers. So I don't know exactly what the issue of things, but I noticed that things are not going in the right way because most of civil association and political parties and many of the population manifested their disapprobation concerning the council. I think today is the main focus of the event in the big city of our country.
What are the opposition parties saying? We understand they are telling Chadians not to obey the orders of the new military council.
You know, the real problem is that after the case of death, all the Chadian hope that something new will take place. But they were surprised with this figure of this council. So they said that most of them, they deny this new system through this council because they're not showing the skill of democracy. Because if they want to help the country or help the people, they must call on all the opposition to sit down and to draw a new politic of conduct the country, but it's not the case. You know, all the Chadian know that Idriss Déby was supported by France. So it is the feeling of contest the position of France supporting this council, and all the opposition, the civil society, deny this new approach of France on the benefit of the countries.
The late President Idriss Déby was a very good friend of France. Now, I understand the opposition is calling on France to side with the Chadian population.
Knowing that France has his own interest in Chad, its society and many French company in establishing our country. So they use the President Idriss Déby to deal with djihadists. So one hand is saying that Déby was the fight hand of France because part of French military established here to do the job. So France was the first country to not saying clearly or condemn the council because it was not quite democrat. So according to my understanding, France is trying to play a game that Chadian knew early.
Clement Abaifuta is the president of the Association of Victims of Former Chadian President Issen Habre's Crimes. He was speaking with us from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. Kenya's High Court this week declared unconstitutional the positions of chief administrative secretaries. The positions were initiated by President Uhuru Kenyatta in what some say were awards to his political supporters who lost in the 2017 general election. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, the officers have been advised to appear for a vetting process in the National Assembly.
I have decided to establish a new position in government, the position of Chief Administrative Secretary in all our ministries.
That was Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta in January 2018 declaring the new position of the Chief Administrative Secretary that was meant to award his political supporters who lost election in the 2017 general election. In the ruling made on Tuesday by the Kenya High Court Judge Anthony Mrema, the positions are unconstitutional and that cabinet secretaries who served under President Kenyatta's first term were supposed to be vetted afresh for second term as well as the new position formed. However, this did not take place 3 years later. Petitioner of the case, activist Okiya Omtata, said that the president did not include public participation and other constitutional bodies that are supposed to approve the nominees.
What the president had done was against the law, and so I moved the court seeking the court's determination of the issues. Unfortunately, the court agreed with me on all the issues that the cabinet secretary's tenure, because he's handpicked and recommended for appointment by the president without competitive recruitment, is tied to the tenure of the president.
Justice Mrema said that any permanent secretary not competitively recruited by the Public Service Commission is in office illegally. Omtata said that Public Service Commission failed in its mandate and that they never did any due diligence in allowing the new positions formed by the president.
Public Service Commission failed in execution of its mandate because the president wrote to it on 23rd of January 2018 and it returned its verdict on 24th of January 2018 within a period of 24 hours, which leaves any reasonable person to conclude that they never did any due diligence on the request, including holding public participation to find out what the public, Kenyan public, thought about it.
President Kenyatta is known for not obeying court orders as he has had a difficult time with the judiciary that led to early retirement of the former Kenyan Chief Justice David Maraga. Lawyer Dunstan Omari says the president may not honor the court orders.
There is room still to challenge that decision in the Court of Appeal. President Uhuru Kenyatta might likely get a stay either before the same judge or before the Court of Appeal. Two, the president is known not to obey court orders. Is this one of the many court orders that the president is likely to disobey? Most likely, the president is likely not to obey the court orders.
Mr. Omari says the appointment of the positions are unconstitutional since they did not follow the law.
His appointment of the chief administrative officers have been found to be a contravention of several provisions of the Constitution, and therefore the court has said those appointments are null and void. There is no provision under the Kenyan Constitution for reappointment of a minister or a cabinet secretary. Every time the president's term ends, the cabinet secretary's terms end, he will appoint them afresh.
According to the court order, all those who were appointed and were never vetted afresh, for those who were reappointed by the president, must go to parliament for fresh vetting, and if found unfit, they will be surcharged under the Kenyan law. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Somalia is bracing for record levels of displacement this year as drought ravages parts of the country, leaving tens of thousands of people without water and livelihoods. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
Somali officials say many areas across the country are currently experiencing drought triggered by below average rainfall. Norwegian Refugee Council data revealed that tens of thousands of people have been displaced across the country in the past 3 months due to recurrent drought and violence. The NRC says people are abandoning their homes with the livestock to search for better conditions. Mohamed Abdi, who is the country's director for NRC, operating in the Horn of African country, said livelihoods have been significantly disrupted by the lack of rainfall as well as conflict related to scarcity of resources.
Approximately 112,000 persons have been displaced primarily by drought and conflict in the first 3 months of 2021. We're talking about people leaving their current places where they have livelihoods and moving to areas in order to look for water and pasture. The worst affected regions include Lower Juba, Middle Juba, Gedo, Modok, Nugal, Bari, Togdel and Sol region.
Farmers in the Middle Shabelle region of Hirshabelle State, who are supplying the capital Mogadishu with essential vegetables and fruit, said their harvests have been affected by the delayed rains. Water levels in the two main rivers of Shabelle and Juba are expected to decrease further as no rains are foreseen in the coming 2 weeks. Hussein Mahdi is one of the affected farmers. He says the last time he planted in his farm was in August of last year. He says a locust infestation also had an impact and the farmers didn't receive help from the authorities to protect their little harvests. Water and pasture resources are getting depleted in the most of the affected areas, leading to abnormal migration of livestock and communities. Somali authorities appeal for more support.
Urge partners to ensure that aid received in people's communities rather than after they're displaced. We urge international community to also increase support for the Somali government and international partners working locally so that we are able to meet the demands of this looming crisis.
According to NRC, only 13% of the UN appeal for $1.9 billion US dollars in aid for Somalia has been received so far. Mohamed Kaye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 22nd. A new report highlights the gap in how education, formal and informal, is viewed on the African continent. A survey of 600 people in Nigeria, Kenya, and South Africa looks at the future of work across the continent. In the report, a real-life example of two brothers in Togo, one who stayed in the village to farm and scrapes out a living, but whose family is not proud of him. The other brother earns a university degree and becomes the pride of his father, but cannot find work. Mark Smith, the general manager of LOCA, an agency that produced the report, tells Ricky Schreier that another finding of the report is that a majority of people surveyed say they prefer to be self-employed, like the brother in Togo, who is a farmer.
These two brothers represent the majority of the reality for most of the workforce, which is on one side a rather rural workforce living in villages and working the land with low levels of education, and on the other end, a workforce that is getting an education but then struggling to find work. Today, you have 20 million people joining the workforce each year, but only 9 million are finding work. And out of these 9 million, 6 million are in the informal sector.
One of the interesting things, too, is that one in four people thought by 2040, farmers would be the profession their country need the most, right behind IT software engineers, which highlights kind of a lot of the disparity the report talks about between urban and rural divide, education, formal education, informal education. Can you kind of tell me about this chasm that, you know, that specific example represents in the job market and the way people view the job market?
Yes. So first, we picked 2040 because by 2040, about one in four people on Earth will be African. And so related to rural-urban divide, a lot of people wish for more farmers in their countries. What was interesting, I thought, is that when we asked them what they would recommend their kids to study, close to 5% only said farming or agriculture. There is a gap there as well. There's also a gap in the sense that there's very low levels of manufacturing or artificial intelligence in Africa. So a lot of these reports on the future of work are quite optimistic or not very realistic. And that's part of the reason why we wanted to do a study that was actually gathering the perceptions from the crowd rather than sectorial analysis or crystal ball prediction. Now, the last one, the rural urban divide, is that most people actually said that life is better in the city right now. But if there was something to earn in the village, if there was money to earn there, 68% of people would be ready to move back. And that's something that we may not consider often enough, the potential for a reversed exodus.
A lot of people felt that farmers were what their country needed most. A very small percentage, you said, would recommend their children to go into farming. Did you guys figure out why that is? Is it about the earning potential, or is it about how farming is viewed from a society standpoint?
We see definitely that there's a social aspect to that. So there are a lot of beliefs surrounding the village, but there's also this sense that there is a progression from the village to the city and potentially beyond the country. That's one thing, the social stigmas that often surround the village. A second is a more harsh reality that when there are very little jobs in the villages, when agriculture is becoming more difficult, when there are low levels of machinery, which we talk about in the report as well, then it's very hard to earn a living in these places. Potentially a last thing, which we didn't really dive into the report, but simply that we're looking at young people and looking for a chance to seek adventure in the city.
That was Max Smith, general manager of LOCA and the author of the report that looks at work in Africa. You're speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Cameroon's agricultural sector employs the majority of the country's workers, but too many know too little about the soil, resulting in inefficient farming. To help Cameroon's farmers, a computer engineer created an electronic analysis kit to test soil quality and suitability for crops. Moki Edwin Kizika has this report by Anne Nzuanku in Adier, Cameroon.
26-year-old Cameroonian Rostang Sime last year spent all his savings to start a plantain and banana plantation. But like all new farmers, he has struggled with efficient production. Sime says the bananas have been growing for 13 months. He says this raises a lot of questions. Sime heard about a Cameroonian company that helps farmers in remote areas to analyze their soil quality and to help choose crops. Technology startup Clinic Agro created a kit with a mobile application called Clinic Soil for instant soil testing. Founder Pyrus Kudjo says he invented the kit to help farmers who were losing money. He says it is very important today for the farmer to be able to analyze his soil. Why? Asks Kodjo. Because knowing his soil means being able to secure his investment, reduce the use of pesticides and input costs, and improving productivity and agricultural profitability. Most Cameroonians work in farming, as agriculture is one of the main staples of the economy. But experts say many farmers are not trained to analyze soil for efficiency. Agronomist Roderick Ngono trains farmers at the state Bingela Practical School of Agriculture.
Et cela nous ramenait peut-être à voir des une approche aujourd'hui que nous, vers laquelle nous allons en agriculture.
He says soil analysis is key to getting better results and leads people towards precision farming. It is about determining the exact amount of nutrients that a plant will need, says Ngono, in order for it to be produced profitably. For farmer Simu, the clinic soil analysis shows his soil quality is poor and very acidic. The app recommends he switch to planting cucumbers, lettuce, eggplant, pineapple or cassava.
Nous ne comptons pas nous arrêter.
After the results, farmer Sime says he does not intend to stop farming, especially since he now has a partner with Clinic Agro, which is supporting him. He says he will move to new land, test new samples of soil, and then move on to crops other than plantains. Clinic Agro says in just 1 year since its creation, its mobile kit has tested soil quality for nearly 1,000 farms in Cameroon. For Anne Zwanke in Edeya, Moki, Edwin Kinzuka, for VOA News.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet is calling the guilty verdict of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the killing of George Floyd momentous and a testament to the perseverance of his family and others in calling for justice. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says the evidence was crystal clear in the prosecution of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. He was found guilty Tuesday of killing African-American George Floyd in police custody. She says any other result would have been a travesty of justice. The High Commissioner says while justice this time was served, justice remains elusive for countless other victims of African descent and their families in the United States and throughout the world.
This case has also helped reveal, perhaps more clearly than ever before, how much remains to be done to reverse the tide of systemic racism that permeates the life of people of African descent. Now is the time to critically examine the context in which George Floyd's killing took place by revisiting the past and examining its toxic traces in today's society.
Bachelet says impunity for crimes and human rights violations by law enforcement officers must end. She adds there must be robust reforms to policing as currently practiced in the United States and elsewhere. Bachelet spokesman Rupert Colville tells VOA the High Commissioner fears the significance of the Floyd verdict will become just one good moment in a long line of terrible events if it is not followed up with concrete action.
And there's a risk that actually we just fall back into the same pattern. So the High Commissioner today is kind of highlighting that we really need to now stop just talking about reform, to do reform and to make it stick, but also to do the much deeper work across society, which is much more difficult, of really trying to tackle with this systemic racism that is prevalent in all societies.
Last June, the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on systemic racism and police brutality against people of African descent following the killing of Floyd by Chauvin on May 25th. Colville says High Commissioner Bachelet will present a report on this issue during the council's upcoming June session. He says the report will contain recommendations for transformative change, better policing, and strengthening accountability for crimes against people of African descent and other minority groups. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's it for this Thursday, April 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines has started as new variants of the coronavirus are spreading across Africa. Join me, Linor Mudu, and a panel of experts to answer your questions about COVID-19, the vaccines, and assess Africa's response 1 year after the pandemic on a special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including U.S. President Joe Biden invites world leaders to a virtual summit on climate change as Earth Day is celebrated internationally. Biden hopes to reach deals with some of the world's largest greenhouse gas emitters. Don't miss issues in the news this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.